Welcome to the podcast, The Menopausal Transition, Optimally Protecting Emotional Health. I'm Gloria Bachman. I'm a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Rutgers Robert Wood Johnson Medical School, and I'm here with two of my Rutgers colleagues, Dr. Jeff Levine and Dr. Nancy Phillips. Dr. Levine, can you say a few words about yourself?
Hi, everybody. Yes, I'm Dr. Jeff Levine. I'm professor and director of reproductive and gender health programs in the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health here at Rutgers Robert Wood Johnson Medical School. And I'm really delighted to be part of this podcast, something I think so important to primary care providers, and certainly in terms of dealing with patients with depressive symptoms, very common, but I think what sometimes can be very confusing and elusive is how to best manage these symptoms in patients who are going through the menopausal transition.
And I'm Dr. Nancy Phillips. Hi, I'm happy to be here. I am a professor in the Department of OBGYN at Rutgers. I'm also the director for the Center for Vulvovaginal Health, which includes menopause, perimenopause, and menopausal symptoms.
Okay, so let's start with a global view of menopause. And I think that there are three important aspects. And the first is that all of us as clinicians are going to be seeing more and more perimenopausal and menopausal women. Let's think about it. In 2011, women over the age of 50 were 21% of the population. By 2021, this group accounted for 26% of all women and girls globally. So the numbers of menopausal patients and obviously perimenopausal patients is increasing. As well, menopausal symptoms, including depressive symptoms, can affect not only women in their 50s and 60s, but they can continue into their 70s and 80s. So that as a clinician, we can't say, okay, we don't have to worry about menopausal symptoms because the patient is 60 or 70, but rather there are many studies that suggest these symptoms can continue into a woman's 70s and 80s. And I think, as Dr. Levine Jeff said, that perimenopausal and menopausal symptoms can affect how the woman feels emotionally, the depression, as well as the physical, the mental, and the social well-being aspects of her wellness. So there are many, many, many reasons why this is such an important topic for all of us to focus on. And unfortunately, for many healthcare providers, it's not part of the curriculum during their training. So perimenopausal and menopausal medicine is not always something that a practitioner goes into practice with and has a full understanding of. And I think another really important aspect is we as the healthcare team have to be comfortable discussing the menopausal issues that a woman may have that's affecting her wellness, that not only her wellness, but her family's wellness, her career, her relationships, and her self-development. And again, it's not only about hot flushes and night sweats, but it's also about the other symptoms, including the depressive symptoms that many women have. So I'd like to start by asking both Jeff and Nancy, how do you bring up the topic of perimenopause and menopause in your patients who you're seeing that would fall into this age range between 35 and above? Jeff, you want to start?
Sure. I think it's very important to be proactive in asking questions about symptoms that are related to perimenopause to these patients, because very often I find patients do not associate these symptoms to the fact that they may be having hormonal fluctuations. And often you can delay diagnosis and managing something that can dramatically impact their quality of life. For instance, a lot of the patients, one of the first signs of going through menopause transition is actually changes in their bleeding pattern. And a lot of them think that that's just normal. Then they may have hot flushes or night sweats, sometimes being disabling enough to interfere with their sleep. And then if they're not sleeping well, they can become irritable and then have mood changes. And again, a lot of times they don't associate that there may be related to hormonal fluctuations, and that this is just something that they have to put up with. So my advice is to proactively ask patients one about menstrual changes or bleeding patterns, and then are they having any of these symptoms? And if so, are they impacting their quality of life?
So then, Jeff, you actually ask the women about the specific symptoms. You just don't say, oh, you're perimenopausal. Are you having any problems?
I have to be honest, I didn't used to do that. And what was shocking is how many times I just assume, well, patients will bring it up that they're having them. And I found the opposite is true. And there are many differences culturally or otherwise why oftentimes patients do not bring these up unsolicited. And if I were not to ask them, I probably would never know, and they would suffer in silence.
Mm-hmm. Oh, how true. Nancy, what about your approach? How do you bring up the topic of the perimenopause, menopause in your patients?
Well, Gloria, coming from a gynecologist point of view, I think that we routinely talk about periods and menstrual bleeding and irregular bleeding, which is a good introduction in terms of irregularity. But I think, as Jeff said, when we have somebody in the age group, even if they're not presenting with menstrual problems, we almost have to be like doctor detective and really talk and really have a conversation with our patients. If they're having irregular bleeding, that's an easy jump off point where we can talk about some of the other perimenopausal symptoms they may or may not be feeling, or tell them what to expect, what may be coming up in the next year or two. If they are having regular periods and they are approaching the age of the perimenopause, I think that's also, we need to be proactive, as Jeff said, in speaking to them about what they might expect, what is a sign of trouble that they may need to see us for, that some of the symptoms may not be dangerous to them, but certainly impact their quality of life. And that part of our job and part of what we want to do for them is to continue to let them have a good quality of life during that time. And I think mentioning the physical symptoms, the psychosocial symptoms like the irritability or some memory, concentration problems, the anxiety or depression, as well as the vaginal symptoms, you know, which they now call genitourinary syndrome of menopause, which are some of the problems that happen with sex, including pain, desire, dryness, decreased desire, dryness, things like that. So it can be a long conversation, but I think it's important to at least touch on it. And if it sounds like this is something that we really need to look at further, not be afraid to reschedule at a time when we can really pay attention to the patient.
So I'm going to just ask Jeff a question. I'm the patient and in the media, and I'm 55, and in the media, I read about hot flushes and night sweats. And then I see you and I'm a little reluctant. And you talk about many symptoms, and then you talk about depressive symptoms. And then I get a little upset and I say, do you think I'm depressed, Dr. Levine? I mean, how do you make the individual feel comfortable that you're not focusing on, oh, I think you're depressed? Because an individual may, or a woman may feel that, gee, is there something that I show in my face that I'm depressed? How do you bring that up?
I think the first thing, just like I have to do to a lot of my healthcare colleagues and learners, is one is that, you know, menopause is not like a light switch. You don't go from reproductive age to menopause. There's this perimenopausal or menopausal transition that could take months or years. And during that, there are a lot of changes due to especially estrogen fluctuation as opposed to deficiency that can cause not only those hot flushes, night sweats, but it is a window of vulnerability that leads to susceptibility to depressive symptoms and major depression. In fact, that is the highest percentage of women in that age group in terms of developing depressive symptoms. And the theory is that these hormonal fluctuations increase their sensitivity to life stressors that maybe at other times of their life they would have been able to deal with more straightforward. And so helping them understand that along with their hot flushes and night sweats, it is very common in my patients that many of them develop mood symptoms, such as irritability or feeling sad or having decreased sexual desire. Are these symptoms that you're experiencing? And if so, how long have you had them? And how much are they impacting your quality of life? So I think normalizing that it's common and that if it's impacting you, I want to know so that I can help.
That I think is the key, the normalizing. But I'm going to ask Nancy this happened to me, that I was seeing a perimenopausal woman who came in with her teen daughter, and she wanted the daughter there with her. And the daughter told me, gee, my mom's been so depressed. And the mother said, not at all. I'm not depressed. How would you handle that if another person's with the patient who you're seeing and they're saying, my mom's depressed, she's perimenopausal, so this would obviously be something that could be from the menopause, but the patient herself is denying it?
Well, I think in that situation, you have a conversation and you say to the daughter, what in your mother's actions, activities, or in your observation make you think that your mom is depressed? And see how the mom reacts to it. And if the daughter says something like, well, she won't let me go out at night because she doesn't trust me, that's not really depression. But if she says, well, she really used to love to come to my softball games, but now she doesn't want to come out of the house anymore, it might be that she does have some depression that she's not recognizing. And I think it's important for us to tease out the symptoms of depression versus the symptoms of menopause. Does she not want to go to the softball games because she's hot and she gets hot flashes and she's embarrassed? Does she have to go to the bathroom every 10 minutes so she doesn't want to have to go somewhere where there's not a bathroom she likes? Or does she really have this general feeling of not wanting to do things and not wanting to leave the house? Does she have a history of depression? Could this be a time when the depression is resurfacing? And I think that's what you have to do. And you can't blame everything on menopause, and you can't discard menopause or discount menopause, but you also have to look at, you know, is this a primary depression? Is this a reactivation of a prior depression? Or is this kind of secondary to the symptoms of menopause, which are affecting your life in such a way that it may appear like depression, but we're not treating you classically like depression, rather the symptoms that are contributing to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Nancy, you brought up something very interesting. I'd like to ask Jeff how he handles it. But if I ask an individual, a patient who is going through menopause about depressive symptoms, and they answer me right back, I've been depressed my whole life. How do you handle that? I mean, do you say, is it exacerbated? I mean, tell me a little bit about it. How would you handle that?
I think, you know, very often we go straight to closed-ended questions, but somebody said that to me, I would ask open-ended, can you tell me a little bit more about that? Have you ever been diagnosed as having depression? Have you ever been put on medication specifically for depression? And if so, did it help? If you stopped it, why did you stop? Did you get better? Did it not work? And then that is a patient. I think we are all familiar with a PHQ-2, you know, where if they are having symptoms of depressed mood and a lack of interest, then I would probably perform a PHQ-9. Unfortunately, there is no menopause-specific mood disorder scale. But PHQ-9 is something almost all primary care providers are very familiar with. So if somebody says yes to one of the classic PHQ-2 questions, depressed mood, whether it's all her life or, you know, for a period of time, and or, you know, lack of interest, I would probably perform a full PHQ-9. It'll do two things. One, try to sort out, do they have some depressive symptoms, and how severe is this? They're having some sub-syndrome depressive symptoms, or are they having major depressive disorder? because that's going to also help me decide how I might best manage it. One, if they have a history of it, and two, how serious or severe are these depressive symptoms? And the third thing is, like Nancy said very astutely, is how do these temporally relate to other menopausal symptoms? The hot flushes, the night sweats. If they have bad hot flushes, they're not sleeping, and it makes them irritable. Obviously, that can lead to depressive symptoms. But that combination, history of depression or not, the severity of their depressive symptoms, and are they associated with others, are somatic symptoms common in menopause transition, those vasomotor symptoms, really will help guide me on what the best management may be for them.
Mm-hmm. And Nancy, I asked Jeff before about having a young teen daughter come in. But what about the effect of the partner on the depression? And you are a vulvovaginal expert. How do you handle when the woman says to you, well, I'm really very depressed, and it's because my sex life is horrific now. I mean, with this change, I am just unable to have satisfying sexual exchange. And it's making me very, very depressed. And you know, my relationship with my partner is horrific. I mean, how do you tease out what to do next?
Again, I think it is good patient interaction, open-ended questions, and asking the patient what is her goal. If somebody comes to me with vaginal dryness or painful sex, and her goal is to have penetrative sexual intercourse, either with a male, with a female, using things, other things like fingers or toys, if that's her goal, well, then that's what we work towards. If she comes to me with decreased desire, and sometimes it's not a primary desire problem, but a secondary desire because of having pain, sometimes it's a desire mismatch. Sometimes her desire is still good, but her husband's desire is higher. And so that you need to know, what is the patient's goal? What is her husband's goal? Are they looking for the same goals? And then you have to work on what those goals are or what that compromise is. And sometimes that involves recommending therapy or counseling.
Mm-hmm. So that when it involves a partner, would you do a pelvic exam first, wouldn't you? Just to assess the vulvovaginal area.
Well, absolutely. Anybody who comes in with any kind of sexual complaint, that even if it's a desire complaint, sometimes people don't realize that they don't have desire because they're having pain or they have atrophy. And it's hard to have desire for something that causes pain. So I think, like I said before, we have to take their symptom, look at all the possible related symptoms that may be contributing to it, both the psychosocial, the hormonal, the physiologic, and put that all together to figure out what really is going on. But I also think it's really important when somebody comes to you and says they're having, if you ask somebody, are you having painful sex? And they say yes, before launching into a whole evaluation and treatment, you might just want to say, well, is your goal to have sex? Because sometimes they'll say, I don't really want to have sex, and my husband just got diagnosed with some heart condition, and we're afraid to have sex. I just want to be comfortable. You have to guide what you treat with what the patient wants.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So that it has to be an open dialogue.
Right. And I would also say, going back to the mother with the teenage girl, at some point, I would have the teenage girl step out of the room so I could have a better discussion with the mother where other things may come up, especially sexual things, relationship things. She may not want to talk about her relationship with her husband in front of her daughter or her partner or her significant other.
Okay, now I'm going to bring up a tough question, because with depression, and obviously it can impact relationships and partners, How do you both have someone leave the room when you want to talk about these sensitive issues and a partner comes in, or an adult child comes in, or there's a young child who the mother is caring for? How do you comfortably say, can we talk for a few minutes on, you know, the depressive symptoms, the problem you're having? How do you do that?
I mean, I don't ask. I basically say, now I'm going to talk to your mom, your partner, or I'm going to examine them. And if you can wait in the waiting room, I will come get you when I'm done, unless the patient insists or requests for them to stay in the room. I mean, the patient is the one who's going to guide me. And so there are situations where certainly it's helpful to have the partner in the room, very helpful, especially when it comes to sexual dysfunction. But there are other times, and often patients are the last ones to realize how depressed they are. So very often they can help, but there are certain parts that it's very important, at least for a period of time, to talk alone. Also to identify, to make sure they're not in an unstable or abusive relationship. So sometimes you want to at least have a little time alone just to assess for that. But I would have my patient help dictate that. But usually then I will tell the patient, whoever's with them, to please go wait in the waiting room and I'll come get them. I'd rather ask for forgiveness than permission.
That's a very good point. Nancy, do you do the same?
I agree. I will just request that I have a few minutes with the patient by herself and ask the other person to wait in the waiting room and say that after we finish our evaluation and we're going to talk about where we're going from here, I will bring them back in the room if that's what the patient would like.
I do want to clarify that more times than not, having the partner there is not common, but extremely helpful. So I do want to emphasize, more often than not, it's nice to know, one, that they have a caring partner; two, you can clear up misperceptions; and two, it helps to have them both on the same page with your management plan. And they can provide insight that sometimes the patient isn't even aware of. So just want to clear, while yes, it's important, especially with my minors, I do that, but I think more often than not, it's helpful when they have their partner with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. I find that as well, Jeff, that because it's a two-way street many times. And sometimes you don't recognize some of the issues in yourself that your loved one will recognize. But I want to get back. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say, which is why it's really, I think, important to acknowledge that you're appreciative that the partner is there and that they're taking an interest in that, and that you want to involve them. But for the exam, it may be better for them to step out of the room.
Exactly. Exactly. So we talked about a little bit about the sexual aspects, and another common correlation that I see, and I'd like to hear, Jeff, first, what you do, is an individual who puts equal weight: I'm so depressed and I can't sleep. I'm getting night sweats. And what comes first? What do you do? How do you manage when the patient has two issues that they're dealing with, and they feel that they're separate, that I'm depressed all day, and then I'm getting hot flushes at night, night sweats, hot flushes?
Great question. You know, chicken or the egg, or ever went a cart before the horse, whatever you want to metaphor you want to use. But to me, the three things that help is, number one, do they have a history of depression? They have a history of depression where they treated for it, and did they respond to an antidepressant medicine is very important, because it's not common for patients to develop major depressive disorder. It's very common to get depressive symptoms in perimenopause, like I said, one of the most common, but to develop a first time major depressive disorder is not common. So very often, if they have major depression, you know, a PHQ-9 of 15 or higher, I'm more likely going to start with an SSRI or SNRI. That is the front line of managing depression in all patients, including perimenopause patients, including cognitive behavioral therapy. But especially if they had a history of depression and had responded to an SSRI or SNRI, that's what I'm going to do. The other thing to keep in line is there are several SSRIs and SNRIs that are also effective for improving vasomotor symptoms. I use those in a lot of my breast cancer survivors who don't have depressive disorder. So it is possible to start with an SSRI, SNRI in those patients, and you might not only improve their depressive symptoms, but some of their vasomotor symptoms as well. On the other hand, if they don't score, if they score lower on their PHQ-9, and their overwhelming symptoms are more the hot flushes and night sweats, there is actually evidence that estrogen therapy, whether in hormone therapy or postmenopausal doses or in combined oral contraceptives, can help treat depressive symptoms, especially in perimenopausal patients. And in that those patients, I might choose either if they are also having bleeding cycle issues or pregnancy prevention is important as well, I might start with a combined oral contraceptive. Where they're later in perimenopause and I'm not so worried about bleeding their cycles or pregnancy prevention, I might use a low dose hormone therapy. So history of depression, severity of their depressive symptoms, and their co-somatic symptoms in terms of hot flushes and night sweats. And of course, like Nancy said, the goal, treatment, what is the patient more concerned about? And I have patients who say, I don't care if I'm irritable or you know, too bad, they're going to have to put up with it. I don't want to be having these horrible hot sweats or nights, these hot flushes or night sweats. So that combination, I think, help dictates what I'm going to start first. What's nice is that we have two very beneficial therapies that actually can help treat both. I think it's what's worked before, the severity, and as well as their coexisting symptoms, and not to forget about things like cognitive behavioral therapy, non-pharmacologic things that will help as well.
Exactly. I just want to ask Nancy that one other point, and that is, and sometimes the patient asks me, and you know, they have depressive symptoms, they're in the perimenopause, they'll say, well, how long will this last and how long will I have to have intervention? What do you tell them? How do you give them a guesstimate of, you know, what your plans are and when do you see them again so that you can assess? I mean, how do you counsel them?
That's a really great question without a really great answer, I think. I think whenever you start something new, it's important to see somebody back within the 4 to 6 week range. I think this is an excellent role for telehealth, because if you're not rechecking on any physical abnormalities such as a vaginal problem, I don't think you need to have an exam. So this is an excellent role for telehealth. I tell patients, let's not look at where we're going to be 5 years from now. Let's look at where we're going to be 6 months from now. And this is an ongoing relationship where we may change things. You know, as Jeff was saying, he put it beautifully about how to decide what to treat first. I may treat you first for your hot flushes, and your hot flushes go away and you come back 3 months later. And even though I've spoken to you in between, now all of a sudden you feel more depressed. So it's an ongoing management. And I don't think you should say, well, this has to go on forever, because nobody wants to hear that. I think you have to say this is an ongoing relationship, an ongoing problem. Perimenopause on average can be as short as 1 year, up to 5 years. And some people maybe a little bit longer. And I think you just have to say, we're going to take this one step at a time. And as things change, we'll adapt. And if you do have to be on this for the next 10 years, if it's making you feel good, or if it's making your life better, let's talk about being on it for the next 10 years. Let's talk about the pros and cons of that, especially with hormone therapy, which I don't know that we're going into that here, but I think it's an ongoing relationship and it changes over time.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, one of the comments I also hear is that family members will tell the woman, the perimenopausal woman who comes in with depression or other symptoms, grin and bear it. I didn't take anything. None of your family members took anything. Why do you need anything? What's wrong with you? What do you say to them, Jeff?
I think they're very fortunate that we live in a time now where we recognize depression as a medical condition. That's not only very common, certainly nothing to be ashamed about, and that it's treatable. And especially in the perimenopausal transition or the menopausal transition or this perimenopausal period, we know there's a direct correlation with hormonal fluctuation and increased sensitivity to stressors, where women would otherwise be able to deal with those stressors but become vulnerable to depressive symptoms and depression. It is physiologic and nothing for them to be ashamed about. And it's unfortunate that they have relatives or friends who were not seeking clinical care or were recognized or appreciated that these symptoms were common and could be treated. But fortunately, they're here and I would like to help them. And how can I best help them?
Now I'm going to ask both of you this same question. And obviously, it's a very difficult question. But depressive symptoms, there is a whole spectrum of depressive symptoms. The depressive symptoms where, you know, they're not as severe and interfering with the individual's life versus the person can't get out of bed. So there's a spectrum. How do you ascertain the degree of the depressive symptoms that perimenopausal woman is coming into your office? You have asked her about them and she says, yes, I have them. How do you determine the degree or how it's impacting her wellness, her lifestyle, and possibly even endangering her? Jeff, you want to start?
Well, I like asking open and closed-ended questions, and I like the art of medicine, but there are times where using validated screening tools can be helpful. And I think that's where the PHQ-9 can be extremely helpful. It doesn't exclude me asking other symptoms. If you only use PHQ-9, you'll totally miss all the vasomotor and other symptoms that could be associated. But in terms of determining how serious are these patients' depressive symptoms, do they have, you know, subsyndromal depression, or do they have, you know, if their PHQ-9 is over 15, do they have major depressive disorder, along with, do they have any feelings about hurting themselves or others? And if so, do they have a plan for that? Obviously puts a whole different level on what I'm going to do in the immediacy, right? I think Nancy said, a lot of primary care colleagues tell me, I don't have time to address this. Well, guess what? Most of this, just validating it and telling the patient, let's schedule a time when we can address it together, is okay. This is not going to go away overnight. They probably didn't have it overnight. You don't have to address it in one visit. However, if they report depressive symptoms, I think you're obligated to at least do some type of screening to make sure they don't have major depressive disorder, and certainly that they're not having suicidal or homicidal ideations, because that does have to be treated immediately.
Nancy, you have anything to add to that?
I don't have a lot to add to that. I think Jeff answered that wonderfully. I just think it's important for people, all physicians, all healthcare providers, to know what to do in that situation. Who do you call? Who's your social service? What are your 1-800 numbers? Where do you tell this patient to go? So I think rather than having to say, oh no, what do I do now? You need to know beforehand what you're going to do in that situation, because that situation, although rare, may come up.
But I want to emphasize, depressive symptoms are very common in the perimenopausal patient, but major depressive disorder as a initial diagnosis is not common. It's going to be more patients who had a history of depression. You're probably going to have a high index of suspicion and a heightened awareness for screening those patients anyway. So I want to make sure we understand that I want to encourage and enlighten my primary care providers that this is something you can and should be treating, and not to fear it. Because again, most of these patients can be managed with medicines you are already comfortable using, like SSRIs or SNRIs, and medications you should get comfortable using in terms of hormonal therapy that, especially in this patient population, are very safe and effective.
Well, I want to thank both of you, Dr. Levine and Dr. Phillips, for joining me for this podcast. And I look forward to collaborating with you, the two of you, in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gloria.
And I want to thank our audience for participating in this podcast. And I look forward to having you join us for our future ones as well.